Welcome back to Pace Immigration, paceimmigration.com. Joining us on the YouTube channel and on the podcast, Michael O'Rourke, U.S. and Canadian immigration lawyer. Good to talk to you, Michael.
Hi, Sean. How's it going?
It's going very well. We're getting our history hats on for a little bit here, as well as some immigration stuff. We're going to be talking about the Jay Treaty, which is, you know, very mentionable for Indigenous folks that want to cross the border back and forth between the U.S. and Canada. But we'll go back a little bit to see where it all started. Michael, what is the Jay Treaty?
So the Jay Treaty is a treaty that arose between the very new U.S. government and the British Crown about 10 years after the American Revolution. It was, as you can imagine, tense between British North America and the United States. And there were constant skirmishes and efforts by the British government to limit American trade. So the Jay Treaty was negotiated to try and alleviate these tensions.
Right. We've got here 1794. I've got a couple of photos up of some old guys there, John Jay and King George III in 1794 negotiated the Jay Treaty, negotiated between U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Jay and King George III, ratified by the U.S. Senate in 1795. And as you're saying here, as you said, it sought to ease tensions between the U.S. and Great Britain, define the shared border. And that shared border is kind of what we're really interested in, even up to today, because Article 3 that talks about Indigenous rights is part of that shared border philosophy. Go into that a bit.
Exactly. So Article 3 was a give me, so to speak, to Indigenous people to try and stop them from allying with the French. So the treaty specifically spelled out that Indians, the parlance at the time, Indigenous were allowed to freely pass across the boundary and that they were freely allowed to trade with one another.
Right. And so, you know, then I'll just fast forward really quickly in case people are kind of dozing off, because you and I love the history stuff. They're like, where's this all going? We have the War of 1812 shows up, and the Treaty of Ghent, which basically ended that war, that treaty reaffirmed Indigenous rights of passage, which is really interesting because a lot of the rest of the stuff went by the boards. But the treaty reaffirmed the Indigenous rights of passage, which gets us up to today. And in a nutshell, Indigenous people from the United States from Canada can pass into the United States freely without going through the usual immigration routines that most people do. Is that right?
That's exactly correct. The Treaty of Ghent actually shows up over and over again in the codification of U.S. immigration law. In 1924 was the first Immigration Act, and it specifically spelled out that Indigenous folks were allowed to come in and to visit, to conduct tourism, to work temporarily, and to settle and become permanent residents. It is actually a very streamlined process. It is probably the e-ticket of U.S. immigration law.
Now, I got to stop you there because you're going back to your roots a little bit. Define an e-ticket. What is an e-ticket?
All right. Anyway? So this is like 80s California slang. An e-ticket was Disneyland had tickets before they had daily passes. And an e-ticket was the best thing you could get because it went on all the rides. And the Jay Treaty is kind of like the e-ticket of American immigration because it is actually a process with next to no processes in it.
Right. We'll take a look at it here. To be eligible for U.S. immigration benefits, go through some of this. I mean, obviously, you need to be an Indigenous member, but also you have to have been born in Canada. That is key.
Yes, birth in Canada is the absolute requirement. You have to be of 50% Aboriginal blood quantum, which can be attested to by a letter from your band. It also has to take advantage of this process, you should also have photo ID, either a Canadian passport or a secure certificate of Indian status. You should have your long form birth certificate showing your parents so that you can show your heritage. And they would like to also see that you have an Indian status card or an Inuit enrollment card, just to show that Indigenous Services Canada recognizes you, your band recognizes you, and that you tick off all the boxes.
Okay. Interesting note at the bottom, though. You cannot qualify, though, if you have been adopted. So it's not necessarily that you're a member of a family group. This is all really about bloodlines.
Yes, exactly. U.S. law looks at the blood quantum. That is the only consideration, really. So it doesn't look at a band that might or might not be recognized, although it does actually look at a band that's recognized. You have to be a member of a band in Canada or a tribe in the United States that is recognized by Indigenous Services Canada. But you must also have this 50% blood quantum. So that means that it applies not only to status Indians, but it also applies to Métis and to Inuit as long as you have that blood quantum.
I mean, a shorthand for the 50% would be either your mother or your father. Is that basically what they're looking at? Your
exactly.
mother or your father was Indigenous or is
exactly.
Indigenous. Yeah. Okay, let's carry on to how you do it. So entering the U.S. from Canada, we talked about some of the stuff where you have to furnish those documents. The interesting one for me when you sent me some notes on this is declare your intention that you want to visit or work in the United States. That's fine. But the applying for the green card has a couple of caveats, doesn't it?
Exactly. Well, you have to tell them. So what happens when you drive up to a land border post is, yeah, you usually meet the first officer and then they'll send you to the room or to the building for secondary inspection. And there you have to show your letter from your band, your Indian status card, and any other documentation you've brought with you. And you have to let them know, are you just coming in? Are you coming in to work? Or do you really want to stay and become a permanent resident? And if they do not know that your intention is to become a permanent resident, they don't do the proper paperwork to get you a green card.
I see. Okay. So coming in, you need to just let them, but either way, it's fine. You just have to let them know.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And we'll carry on to what happens if you're already in the United States.
Similar type of process. You just deal with the internal U.S. Immigration Agency, USCIS. You make something called an InfoPass appointment at a field office, and you can do that by calling their 800 number and asking for an InfoPass appointment. You bring the same documents, two passport photos, and then you wait for your green card.
Can you go into the United States? Let's say you're down there for, you know, a year or something like that, and then you go, you know what? Actually, I do want to do the green card. Can you then start that green card process while you're in the U.S.?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and there's no restriction.
And there's no restriction for the six-month rule, like the usual when a Canadian goes down to the United States, they get a visitor visa for 6 months. Is that in an application here?
Exactly. They do not have the same time limits or restraints that a typical Canadian citizen would face.
Okay. Now, I can see why you're calling it the e-ticket, right? Because it's fairly good for getting down there and pretty much doing what you want, whether you want to work there, live there, visit, whatever.
Exactly.
We had some other considerations that we wanted to go over, but I couldn't resist throwing in another picture of old John Jay up there.
If you're watching handsome fella.
Yeah, if you're watching on the YouTube channel, kind of an accomplished guy. Other considerations like social security number, family sponsorship, go into that a bit.
Sure. So if your intent to work is to work in the U.S., you have to get a Social Security number. And Social Security Administration wants to see the same documents that you've provided either to CBP or to USCIS to establish your blood quantum and your membership in a recognized band. So that requires an in-person visit to a Social Security office.
Okay.
Family sponsorship is interesting. So if your say, spouse or your child has the required blood quantum and is a registered member of the band that you belong to, then they can apply on their own, in their own right, under the J Treaty. However, if their only relationship to you is through marriage or birth, and they don't meet the blood quantum requirements, you can then sponsor them to become permanent residents based on marriage or birth. And it goes through the normal processing that a U.S. green card would go through.
So basically, so if your father is indigenous and you are 50%, and then that would mean that your child ostensibly would be 25%. So you are fine going through with the J Treaty and going through those motions, but your child is going to have to wait for your sponsorship.
Exactly.
Okay. Is there a Canadian J Treaty? Because we're talking about Canadians going down to the U.S., no problem. What about American Indigenous who want to come north?
It is a one-way e-ticket. Okay. Unfortunately, Canadian law hasn't evolved the same as U.S. law. After the Treaty of Ghent, there have been a number of cases that have made it through the Supreme Court of Canada. And they have consistently not recognized the rights contained in the J Treaty, saying that most of those rights granted by the treaty had either predated the treaty, especially the right of movement, but not the right to trade. So there's still a customs regime. And an Indigenous person from the United States cannot just freely move into Canada, start working, set up shop. So it really is a very different approach that Canada has taken.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, one thing to know. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Go for it.
But one thing to know is that although the government of Canada has not done this, a number of institutions in the country do have this quasi-recognition of the J Treaty. So like University of Western Ontario, which is now just Western University, University of Saskatchewan, and some others actually will give domestic tuition rates to Indigenous people from the U.S. I mean, it's not the same as the right to work and the right to permanently reside, but maybe it's a baby step.
Interesting. Oh, by the way, and another good thing about that, no fees, right?
Yeah, no fees. So it really is the e-ticket without the cost.
Right. So if you go down, if you go and talk to the border officials and stuff, it's not like paying for a visa or something like that. People contacting you about this, I mean, what do you want to know? I mean, do you need to see people? Do they need your help? Because it sounds like it's fairly easy, but I guess you still have to have your ducks in a row.
It is. Often for my clients that do have J Treaty issues, I don't usually say to hire me because they've done their research, they've got everything in a row. So usually where people end up hiring me is for their spouses or for their children who need sponsorship, because that's a lot more complex. But I'm always happy to talk to people about this, and it is fascinating, and I might either bug them with either U.S. history or California 80s slang, but often they don't need my help for just pure J Treaty movement.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much, Michael, for joining us again today. Michael O'Rourke, the e-ticket of immigration lawyers in Canada and the United States. Michael, we'll see you again. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks so much, Sean. Take care.